Welcome back, everybody, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do as a mediator and a document preparation company. That's all I do, amicable divorces. We have one of my most favorite guests of all time here today. I'm so excited to be doing this episode with you, Dr. Jane Gwynn of Bend, Oregon, who is a doctor in human sexuality. Thank you so much for coming to the program, Jane.
It is such a pleasure to be here with you. Absolutely an honor.
Well, I was so happy after our pre-interview. I could not wait to present you to the audience because I learned so much. But I'm going to give everybody listening a homework task. I want you to go on Amazon and I want you to buy Jane's book with a fabulous title, of course, Too Busy to Get Busy. We know that's about the bedroom. Subtopic, 7 bedroom breakthrough areas. I would love everybody to buy this book, and then Jane has agreed to come back in a few weeks, and we're going to specifically talk about the book. I think the book is going to make a lot more sense to everybody after this talk with Jane, because what I have learned, what you will learn, is A, she has the best job in the world, don't you, Jane?
I totally do. Who would not want my job?
I would definitely want your job.
I think you would.
Great. And after we did the pre-interview, I was so happy and I learned so much. I said, this is going to be a phenomenal talk with the audience. So, Jane, the very first thing is, this is a podcast about divorce, about amicable divorce. So, in presenting this topic of sexuality, if it helps people stay together, great. That's not the intention. The intention for me in presenting this topic is sex is so much a part of the breakdown of a relationship that let's help people learn what may have happened in their marriage so that they can do better for the next relationship.
Absolutely.
And in so doing, let's just start with, how important is sex in a relationship? What role does it have in a marriage?
I love that question, Judy. The thing about sex that I find so compelling is that it's an area where we can both experience satisfaction and see the way we relate to another person. It's almost like this beautiful playground, or it can be a place where we are not playing, but it's really demonstrating to us how we relate. And it's a place where many of the problems that we have in other parts of our marriage are also showing up. So if I'm having a problem communicating with you and you're my partner in my regular life with you, with the kids, with the in-laws, with money, etc., it's very likely I'm having that same problem in the bedroom. And conversely, when I solve a problem with you in the bedroom, in this relationship or in a future relationship, it's showing me that I have these skills and abilities to continue increasing connection rather than becoming mired in power conflicts, which happens so often sexually and in other areas. And it shows that I can open myself to you as a person, and that I can receive you, and that I can hear you, and that I can get my needs filled with you, that I can act out all of my life with you sexually. And then, of course, there's the piece around feeling like I have this relationship with you that is intimate, where we both have shared satisfaction, where we are raw with each other, where we experience passion. And it's the core of a lover relationship. What happens so often is we become parents together, or co-workers, or roommates, instead of lovers. And because we miss that lover piece, our relationship stops feeling like anything at all important. It ends up being just like two people living in a house. And usually when we get to that point, we feel like, well, if I were going to pick a roommate, maybe I'd pick my best girlfriend or I'd live by myself because I'm not getting that much out of my relationship with my husband or my partner now that we're not having sex.
Can a relationship survive or survive for a long time well without sex?
That's another good question. You know, that depends on the people in the relationship. There are couples who, because of their own erotic makeup, do survive well without sex if it's agreed upon by both people. But oftentimes we find that one person has decided that sex is not necessarily part of their life anymore, and the other person is still desiring sex. And even if the two people aren't talking about or negotiating about sex anymore, it's often true that one person feels deeply hurt because the sexual relationship is ended. So if both people have authentically decided that sex is no longer on the table for them for various reasons, then yes, it can survive because it's agreed upon, just like everything in marriage. It's a compatible arrangement, and that's a possibility. But for many people, it's a disconnect, and it's not true that both people have opted out, either intentionally or unintentionally.
Well, in your practice, do you run into many people that come to you and have agreed that it's okay that we don't have sex, we just have these other areas we have to work on?
Sometimes that happens, but because I'm a sexologist and my specialty is helping people develop sexually authentic and satisfying relationships, usually people who come to me are negotiating to make the sex better. Okay. If they don't care about it, they maybe show up in your office, or maybe they, you know, they just continue working on financial issues or some of the other communication pieces that they find challenging.
Do you find that people may downplay, without even realizing they're doing it, downplay the importance of sex in the relationship, and then somehow the relationship isn't working out, and they're looking at the reason being other areas, when it's really they've just disconnected in that most vital part of having a relationship, which is the physical intimacy?
Yeah, I do think that's true. And this happens oftentimes along the way as we're parenting. I have a big family myself. I understand this from my own experience, that becoming what I refer to as a super mom or a super dad and becoming so connected to our children's every need, all of their experiences, and really identifying ourselves in the parenting role can lead us away from being connected as lovers. And sometimes we go through our lives and, you know, as the kids get older, we look across the table and people discuss this all the time. And then, you know, we know that the youngest kid is like a junior in high school and the person across the table from us is really a stranger outside of the parenting role. And so I think that what happens is that people underestimate the importance of sex in favor of other things, and they/we become busy, or in my book I talk about us being too busy, and oftentimes we aren't equipped to solve the sex problems, and so we select our attention, we take our attention over in the direction of the parenting pieces, which are much easier for us to access. We have all sorts of social support for that. Our friends are all doing it. We know how to do it. We know how to solve those problems. We know how to talk about them. And so we keep doing that over and over. But meanwhile, the sexual issues become less and less important to us in our everyday conversations. We don't discuss them. They're fraught with difficulty. There's a lot of hurt feelings and challenges, and we just choose not to discuss them. We think that'll happen later. It's a problem with privacy. It's a problem that has to do with being busy or too tired. And these things are factors, but we don't realize that if we ignore the sexual concerns, they do not solve themselves on their own.
Sex defines us, doesn't it? Our own sexual identity in large measure defines how we present ourselves, does it not, to the world?
Absolutely. I feel it has so much to do with our vitality, our sense of self-expression. It has a tremendous amount to do with our inner confidence as either a man or a woman. and with our sense of being accepted at our core, because it's literally a naked activity. So when we're accepted by a partner in our nakedness, we are truly seen. We are truly pleasured in our nakedness, which is a totally different thing than we experience in any other part of our life.
When people get together initially and have that wonderful attraction that is so great at the beginning of every relationship, how do they know, initially whether they are matched well, or is this something that you must spend time on? You must spend time with each other to know if you're matched properly.
Are you thinking about sexual compatibility?
Yes.
Well, one of the things that happens with us or to us in this new relationship energy that you reference, so that turn on, that excitement with a new partner, is we are experiencing a high tide or high flow of erotic energy. Like if you think about, I know you're in Southern California, if you've ever been up by Yosemite and seen some of those beautiful rivers like the Merced coming out of that beautiful valley, in the springtime when the runoff is there, these rivers are full. And you can just ride those rivers on a raft or a kayak or a canoe if you're skilled without ever concerning yourself with the rocks. And to me, that is what's happening in our lives with this new relationship energy. We're on this flow of erotic charge and we're just going for it. We're paddling, our partner's paddling. It's smooth sailing. It's so easy. But as we go through the phases of our lives, and now we're in the summer of our river experience, and the water is lower and it gets a little lower as the summer goes on, the rocks appear. And we have to be more skilled in order to get through the river, to not run into a rock or hit an eddy. And most of us don't have the skills for that. So in answer to your question, that new relationship energy does definitely allow us to flow over rocks that we are not aware of. And when we've had more time together, we need to become more skilled. We still may have the same power and surge in our sexuality together, but oftentimes what happens is because we don't understand each other and we don't work well together in our canoe or our boat, we run into the rocks. For example, maybe I'm someone who's had some kind of a traumatic sexual experience as a younger person. When I'm really turned on to you, then I'm not experiencing that. But as I get lower in my erotic charge, then I start to feel held back and I don't have the same access to my sexuality. And you have to be more skilled to help me kind of navigate that, because now my turn on is not helping me just to keep flowing over all the rocks. And that's something that happens to so many people. We don't have the ability to know what the challenges are. And because of that, we get clunky. We say things that hurt each other's feelings. And we don't realize that perhaps this is a very significant issue to you. Maybe we don't know that our partner, you know, is very tender about a certain issue around body image for a man or a woman, or that there's some pieces around privacy that we in the past didn't even notice because we were so hot for each other, you know, that if the kids were in the next room or something else was going on, it wouldn't bother us. But now that we're a little less turned on, these things need to be talked about. We feel like the other person is not sensitive and somehow doesn't get us or just cares about themselves and is selfish. And so we start defining our partner differently because they don't know how to navigate with us.
You know, that is of course so true. And that is so much a part of life. We are not taught, are we, at least in this country, how to talk about our sexual needs and truly express ourselves in a sexual way in different phases of our lives, are we?
Exactly right. Right. And we do assume, however, it's very interesting that we assume that the young, hot, and fit among us have amazing sex all the time. They're turned on. They're so, you know, they look great, so they must have great sex. We assume that that's the case for them, and that as people get older, that their sex becomes you know, blasé or, you know, just awkward at best and terrible at worst. But that's just not true. We have these assumptions that we make about the phases, the times in our lives that sometimes limit us. We get limiting beliefs in the area of sex. And so when we get to a certain age, like menopause, so many people just assume women become asexual after menopause and that there are no solutions for postmenopausal women to have great sex, which is just not true. And there's lots of ways that women, even if they don't want to choose hormone replacement therapy, can have amazing erotic sex lives postmenopausally. But because we don't talk about sex, we don't ever discuss these things, you know, around a table usually. A few people do, but it's so we don't have access to the shared understanding that a group of people might bring us in other areas like finance or, you know, stress management or all the other things we talk about just constantly. We just don't talk about sex very much. We don't talk about sex enough.
You know, that brings up so much. I was thinking of, as you were talking, one of the first things I was thinking of was, I have never been attracted to a man because of the way he looked. That typically hot man, the football player, the model. I kind of go for the nerds. And I have found that the nerds are very compassionate. It's what's inside of us that comes out when we're intimate with people. And that's not defined by how we look, is it?
I completely agree with you. We make assumptions that some people, because they've been objectified by our society as being sexy to look at, that those people are going to be embodied, unselfish, giving lovers. And that's not true necessarily, because many of the people who are objectively, quotes, gorgeous are really self-conscious about their appearance, you know, have always been told that they are a certain way and have been told that they're supposed to be sexy or sexual. And I think it's oftentimes a burden for people. So as we shed that and we stop doing what I refer to as spectatoring with regard to ourselves sexually, like watching ourselves and wondering whether our, you know, something looks weird on our leg or, you know, if our breasts for a woman, you know, is like, if it looks saggy in some position, or do we have some kind of like thing with our abdomen that like somebody's going to think looks not cute. When we are spectatoring like that, what happens is we aren't really in the moment. And this oftentimes happens with certain people, certain of us. We can't actually let go. I hear this all the time. We're in our head. And so our partner feels that. They feel like, oh, you're not even really here when I touch you. I feel like you're like a million miles away. What are you thinking about, honey? A penny for your thoughts. What's going on? And our partner, maybe the person who's self-conscious, just doesn't know how to be self-accepting, because it is challenging to be a sexual person in the society. We are told that it's, first of all, not okay, and that we should somehow be a little bit embarrassed, particularly those of us who are living as women have been told that this is somewhat shameful. And we think that we're supposed to act some kind of porn starish way, which is all a bunch of lies. And you know, we're supposed to be present. We're supposed to be what will help us and help our partner is if we actually show up as a person, a real person in the bedroom, not some kind of pretend example of what a sexual person would be. Actually ourselves. Really the easiest thing we could ever do is to be honestly ourselves rather than something else.
That just feels so refreshing. When anybody talks about authenticity and having the comfort and the confidence to just be who we are, my whole body relaxes when I think about that for myself. It's wonderful. And you raised another good point, and that is, I think in this country, as opposed to maybe some European countries, maybe some South American countries, women are, and I'm going to use a word you had used when we spoke earlier, that is muted. Mm. We mute ourselves sexually, especially women, do we not?
Absolutely. Yep. We don't express who we really are and what we really want. And when our partners get a chance to meet us authentically, when we are unmuted, when we've taken the, mute button and taken it off, and we're voicing ourselves. Our partners just love that. And that's for women who are with other women and women who are with men. Our partners want to hear from us. They want us to be real. They want us to share our voice, our female copulatory vocalization, which is that sound that women make when they're being sexual, which is not to say that you have to be a noisy woman to be a good sex partner, but it's natural for our bodies that we are expressing sexually. And when we use our voice and our words to tell a partner what we like, what we don't like, it's tremendously well received, because then our partner knows how to help us have the most enjoyable and satisfying experience possible with them.
Especially if they're the right partners for us, right?
Absolutely.
So could you please go through now, Jane, what women like, what men like? And I'll start you off by something you had said before. You said women like quality sex, men like quantity. How do we put the two together?
You know, that you're referring to an interesting study that talks about the way the satisfaction that married couples are said to have. These studies have studied married people, and it's been shown that in these marriages, if men are getting enough quantity of sex with their wife, so frequent enough sex with their wife, they will be satisfied. Whereas women in these studies are shown to become bored when the sex doesn't have enough variety and enough, I want to say granularity, something that feels like it's not formulaic, that doesn't feel like box checking. Like we do this, we do this, we do this. Something that feels more enlivening to a woman. When women get, so I would call that quality sex, more variety, more engagement, more intimacy. Women often talked about wanting more connection, intimacy, passion. And men wanting more quantity, so that they want to have a certain number of episodes in a month, say. So that difference is really significant, because when a man is expecting a certain quantity of sex from, say, his wife, and the woman is not getting the quality of sex that she prefers, and it feels somewhat boring, she will be less likely to offer the sex. She will become more closed down, tightened, and less erotically charged. Then the man will have less opportunities to be sexual. And it oftentimes happens that in those cases, the woman likes it even less, because if the man rushes the sex because he's feeling pressured that he hasn't had enough sex, he has a tendency then to approach her in a certain way that isn't open and flowing, isn't slow and allowing, which is what women have a tendency to like, is to allow to have a sex experience that might go all sorts of different ways in a particular episode. It might be fast and furious this time, and it might be languorous and, you know, sensual another time, but not always the same. For many women, this is true. And so when he stops offering the variety and just wants to get it done, she's even less likely to want to do it. And so this happens often, where couples then become less and less sexual because the sex gets tighter and shorter in its expression, which makes the woman less and less interested, which makes the frequency drop down. And pretty soon you have a sexless marriage, defined as six or fewer sexual episodes, typically intercourse if it's a male-female couple, in one 12-month calendar period.
Would you please say that again?
Yeah.
What's the number again?
Six or fewer sexual episodes over a year. So typically intercourse.
Wow. Mm-hmm. It really can reduce to that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, I actually, why am I even asking that question? In my divorce experience, I've run into several couples with one or two minor children, and they have not had sex since the last child was born.
Right.
Who's in school.
Right. No, I have that. That's one of the groups of people I have a tendency to work with, the people who haven't had sex, or if they've had sex, it's been maybe she's provided him with some kind of sexual outlet, but not sexual intercourse. Maybe she's stimulated him with her hand or mouth, but they haven't had any penetrative sex, which both people would have considered both real sex. Obviously arguable, but they maybe for a period of 10 years that they have not had any other type of sexual connection. I've had one couple where they had not had any sexual contact at all for 6 years, not any, nothing, no touching, nothing. And it's not uncommon for people to have had just a few episodes in the previous year when they work with me, maybe four times, maybe once in January, three times in the fall, you know, something over Christmas, that kind of thing.
You know, this is fascinating because we would never agree to marry somebody if we didn't first have a sexual relationship with them. I mean, in general, there may be some cultures where you can't have sex, but that's not how we live in the United States for the most part. And I always find that fascinating. And I can even relate to it in the breakdown of my own marriage some years ago, that all the other issues of compatibility were obvious, and then they just showed themselves in the breakdown of the intimate relationship. And that's when we knew, well, we had something very serious to talk about. Now, on the other side of that, I'm going to call your attention to the 50 Shades of Grey trilogy, the three movies that have different versions of 50 Shades of Grey. I found this fascinating. The first one was, of course, groundbreaking in this country that we would have a film like this. But the second film, the second part, was even more fascinating because the female character came into her own power sexually. She was open to this extreme sexual approach by Christian, her partner, in the first movie. And then she left because it didn't satisfy her. It was too painful, too crazy, too wild, beyond what she could deal with. And now we have part two, when she sets the terms up for how the relationship's going to be, because he came back to pursue her. And she was so much in control, and she allowed him to be who he was with a more healthy version of himself. And she became so in control of herself and the relationship, I said, I totally want to be this girl. Can I?
You may. You absolutely may. Yeah. And you can. You both can and you may. Because being a powerful sexual woman is so attractive to people who, you know, to men or women who have sex with women. It's so attractive when we are confident. And whether we're confident in submission or confident more dominantly, when we have voice about what we want, that there's nothing as hot as that. You can be the least physically appealing woman out there, and when you speak with a sexual voice that has the confidence imbued in it, you are a sexual magnet for other people. Because that's what we want, is someone who can own that sexual energy and the connection with us. We want to be held by that. We want to feel comfortable that the other person, our partner, is able, when they welcome us, that they are all there and that they are grounded in themselves. People want that from us.
You're so right. I just started thinking of people that I knew who I found happily quite surprising that they weren't the model of beauty, yet they were so attractive.
Yep.
Their inner energy, their confidence was so attractive. And some of my other friends tell me, my female friends tell me, who are in heterosexual relationships, Judy, they just want to see you naked. That's all they want. It's all a man. I couldn't care less how you really look. They just want to see you naked. Are they right?
Well, there is a funny joke about what do you call a guy who's in a hotel room with a naked woman, and the punchline is lucky. You call the guy lucky. Because I do think that there's this shielding of us in our bodies because we are so clothed and we live in really a kind of a provincially oriented society. So, you know, we women, you know, we now there's all this thing about like bralessness in COVID, the COVID braless experience that people are in.
I have not heard this.
Oh, it's huge. Everyone's like, all these people in my social media structure are like, you know, there's no bras anywhere. They're, you know, they've left them behind in the rearview mirror. But generally, you know, we're pretty modest in this culture if you think about other cultures.
Well, wait, and, is that because you're working from home and so is your partner working from home? Is
no, it's because the people I'm talking to, I must say, I'm actually a fan of bras. It's not because I'm repressed, but I just happen to be. But a lot of my friends and people I know are just deciding to live more freely in their bodies. Maybe it's because I'm a yoga instructor and that's part of the people, some of the people I know. But okay. I do think that there's a releasing of some of the expectations that we've had as women about our clothing. And you know, because we're staying home, a lot of people have kind of shifted the way they dress. And because of that, we're becoming maybe a bit freer. But in our general way of expressing in the culture, we're a modest bunch as Americans. And so then if you think about men or other people, you know, I keep referencing other people who like to have sex with women, i.e. not always lesbians, but people who like to have sex with women, men and women who like to have sex with women. We like to see female bodies. They're beautiful to us of all types. And so, yeah, men like to see us naked. You're right. They do. They want to see our bodies. And why shouldn't we see each other's bodies? When you think about it, it might be much healthier for us because then we'd realize that not everybody looks like Barbie. Like Barbie's a plastic doll. She can't even stand up. If you put Barbie, she would not be able, you made her into a human. She would never be able to walk around. Like she's not real.
You know, that is so true. We have, at least my generation, I was born in 1952, I did grow up with Barbie. And I do have a feeling that that shaped my self-image just a little bit. And it just as I grow older, it's very interesting, as I grow older, I have grown in confidence about myself. I'm so right. happy. It could have been the opposite way, and that would have been tragic, but it didn't turn out that way. You know, you were saying something when we were talking a few weeks ago that I would love for you to share with the audience, and that is we don't know how to be sexual in terms of what men like, what women like in terms of being touched and addressed physically. Would you share the differences?
Absolutely. This is something I think is so helpful for us to think about. And it has to do with what I call core and peripheral eroticism. So for women, typically, now, of course, this isn't true for all women, and, you know, it could be true for some men, but in general, women have a tendency to be more peripherally oriented, which means that we hold our turn-on energy, our erotic energy, in our hands, our feet, our head, neck, maybe the shoulders, collarbone area. So when I come to you, if I'm a partner with a woman, I'm a man, I want to be around or connect with my woman, it's really lovely if I start to touch her peripherally. So her hands, maybe I touch her hands, her arms coming, stroking up toward the body. I touch her head and hair. She may like to kiss because that's part of the head and neck, her feet. Instead of, Judy, touching her at where I say the soccer uniform goes. So in the soccer uniform is the core. So the soccer shorts, the soccer shirt, all the soccer moms out there will know what I'm talking about. The soccer uniform, that's where women oftentimes, if they're not aroused, we don't typically want to be touched in those places initially, unless we're turned on. We like to be touched in the core, and I mean, in the periphery, and then our partner brings our erotic energy toward the core. So if you're in a relationship with a woman, stroke her fingers from the tips down toward her elbows, and then lift your hand and stroke again, because you're bringing the energy toward her core. And then pretty soon it starts to enter her core, and then you can start touching the parts of her body that are under the soccer uniform. Conversely, men tend to be core-oriented. And what we want with a man, when we're in a partnership with a man, like I'm married to a man, so his head, that's still part of the core. So we intersect at the head, which is why kissing tends to be a good activity for men and women. So men, the head, neck, men tend to like having their neck touched, and their torso down to the groin and genitals. Men will love it if you just gently, as you walk past them in the kitchen or the bathroom, if you gently touch them on the front of the jeans, like right where the zipper is, and give them a, without being hurtful, obviously, just touching their penis through their pants so they know you recognize that they're there. It's a very loving thing to do to a man, or touching him on the buttocks under over their clothing or the torso. Any of that men tend to love, and they tend to see it as friendly, welcoming, connected. So then with a man, you want to stroke from the genitals and the core out toward the periphery, because that allows a man to be more fully expressed. So when you're touching a man, you bring the energy you stroke from the core out toward the head and neck, toward the arms. And then in each case, both the person, the man or the woman, is fully expressed. Their sexual energy is throughout their body. And that's when you can have a beautiful connection, because both people are really there. The guy's not just focused on his genitals, which tends to be a concern of women, like he's only about his genitals, or he's only about your genitals, and he's not seeing you as a whole woman. He's not really bringing you in, or she is not focusing enough on his core. He feels like she's ignoring what's obviously to him the most important part. Right? And yeah. It's funny to me, because we women, we show this to the world, because we go get our nails done. We get our hair done. We get our toenails done. We're showing. We want people. We want our partner to notice the periphery. That we're saying, like, this is the part. Come over here. It's like, this is the shiny part. This is the part with the colors. I want you to notice. And yet somehow men don't realize we want attention to our periphery. Hands, arms, head.
Yes, and to extend that thought, women, you had said once before, women like to be in public and be admired.
Yeah.
And that can be very disconcerting to a man if he, A, doesn't understand that's part of a woman's sexual being and sexual expression. It doesn't mean she wants another man or another woman. Mm-hmm. It means this is how she enjoys expressing herself.
Yes.
So how should a man handle that properly?
Well, if a man understands that a woman gets her turn on, her eroticism, in reflection, as it's reflected from her environment, from him and from other people, then he'd be welcoming her to be seen and appreciated by others. Because when he takes her home at night, then she is feeling her sexuality, she's feeling sexy, she's feeling aroused, and he is the beneficiary of that. So it's not a threat to him, it's just allowing her to absorb. And if you think about her being peripherally oriented, it's like she has her feelers out, she's bringing it in. In fact, oftentimes when women go to the, you know, some kind of a beautiful event like a gala, I keep thinking about those things, you know, or some kind of other more sexy evening event, she makes sure her hands and her toenails look fantastic. The mani-pedi, you know, is a part of it, and that she has lovely hair. She takes care of her makeup. She wears something attractive. When he sees her out there in a public space with other people who are admiring her, then what I would recommend for men listening to this for future relationships, or perhaps your current relationship, is that you recognize that she's being resourced by those around her. She's filling up her sexual cup. So when she gets home to you, she now sees herself as attractive, and she sees herself as someone who is sexually resourced, and she'll be that for you. So it's no threat.
Excellent, because now we come back to divorce and things that come up in divorce, unfortunately, are the miscommunication of so many aspects of our lives, or the disappointment over what we thought could happen with our lives with each other. And so to stay within the realm of sexuality, there are terms that come up a lot in my line of work, and I'm sure they come up in your line of work as well. And those two terms I'd love to focus on are cheating and trust.
Oh, yes, cheating. I'm talking to a medical staff here coming up soon, and I was looking at some of the info about infidelity. And it looks like among those people who do not get divorced, there's about a 17% rate of infidelity. 17 among people who don't divorce. But among people who do divorce, it's something like 57 or something like that. So it's true that infidelity and cheating do play a big part in people's dissatisfaction. In fact, the studies also show that among women who have experienced their partner cheating, so the guy's cheated, she hasn't, those marriages tend to have only about a 10% in one study. The woman will save the marriage, in quotes, only about 10% of the time in those cases. And in the case where a husband is the victim of cheating or the woman's cheated, it's quite a bit different. He's more likely to be forgiving of a woman who cheats. So really the problem more often, at least according to the studies I was just looking at, are in cases where the husband has cheated. And the other thing I thought was interesting about the information I was looking at is that when there's a difference in the income of the two people in the partnership, when one person makes substantially less money, interestingly, that person is more likely to cheat because of the power difference in their marriage. And also interestingly, when it's a husband who makes 70% of the income in the partnership or more, he's more likely to cheat. So it's really some interesting numbers about cheating, in my opinion, that says that cheating is often about power and about whether we're dependent on someone or whether we feel like our relationship gives us enough power. And whether we feel like we can get away with it, say in the case of men who make more money and they feel the wife is maybe dependent and isn't going to take off, those people apparently are more likely to cheat. And it's very hurtful when someone cheats because the fact that trust is broken, and people often feel that they cannot then trust a partner to be sexually faithful to them. But there are other studies, Judith, that show that when there's been infidelity in a relationship, that it can help a couple to become even more communicative about their needs, to address things more authentically. And so it can be the best thing that ever happened to your marriage if you are able to get through it together.
Well, funny you should say that, because a couple weeks ago, I did a two-part interview back-to-back 2 weeks in a row with a gentleman named Dr. Talal Al-Saleem, and he wrote a book called Infidelity, The Best Worst Thing That Could Happen to a Marriage, or at least to your life. And so, yes, now I'm hearing this again. I want to go back to something, though. Why are men more apt to take women back if the woman has cheated than the other way around?
Well, there's information that says that for men, if their wife has sex with another person, they're more upset about it than if she is emotionally connected to another person. And I think that women have a tendency to be looking for emotional connection. So if we look at emotional affairs, men tend to be less concerned about what we call emotional affairs, sexless affairs, than women are. So that may be one piece that affects it, because perhaps he's like, well, they didn't get naked, or they got naked once, and I can understand that, you know. you know, sex is a high drive for me. And so maybe, you know, I'll take her back for that reason. Whereas for women, there's this sense of if there's any emotional connection between the man and his partner, she's much more upset about it. And I think that there's just something about the culture of women that we have this sense that if the guy cheats, the whole idea of kicking him to the curb is just like rings loud in my ears.
It's the only option. The trust has been broken. You can't get back.
Yes. And it's not safe. Like, I think we feel like he's no longer safe. Whereas I don't know if men fear a woman who cheats. Maybe he thinks she's a very sexual person. You know, I just need to kind of like bring her into me a little more. She's got all this sexual energy, like it's leaking out. I'm just going to kind of corral it back. And women have a little bit different way of looking at it.
You had also said something along these lines when we previously spoke, and that is in regards to the sexual act, women are entered and men do the entering.
Right.
And so does that have something to do with the difference in reactions between men and women to an affair?
I don't know. That's an interesting question. The fact that a woman would see her husband in her mind's eye, you know, entering this other woman. I think women have a tendency to think about sex being more of a personal act. And so we might think about our partner being with another person, a woman, and we might think that they obviously had a lot of emotion connected. It had a lot of meaning that they were making love, as opposed to a guy, a male, who might think that it was just an act and have it compartmentalized. If he thought about his wife having sex with someone else, there are men who, for whom the idea of one's wife having sex with someone else is a huge turn on. So there's some of that that might be at play here. There's a lot, there's just a whole group of people who have fantasy around that. So there may be some of that. As long as she's now finished with the other guy and she's come back and, you know, he understands what happened and he maybe knows, he has conversations with her about how to satisfy her more. And maybe he assumes that some of the things he was doing weren't as satisfying. There are ways that men might approach it differently because they wouldn't assume that she was in love with the other person.
Is it because men can have more emotionless exchanges in sexual activity than women? Do women require emotion to be part of the process more than men?
I don't know if they require it, but it definitely is true that our society sees sex for men as being more of a physical act. And I think that men are socialized to be less vulnerable during lots of parts of their life, and certainly during sex. If you think about porn, which is such a factor for a lot of men, the way they see men having sex, they see men having emotionless sex on a regular basis. And the numbers for the people, the number of people who use porn, I don't know. I just looked at them yesterday, just like an astronomical number of people using porn.
What are the numbers?
Oh my gosh, I knew you were going to ask me that. Hang on 2 seconds. If there's just an astronomical number of people using porn, hang on. Porn sites worldwide are the number 4 visited sites worldwide. So if you take the porn sites, and there are about 4 or 5 different ones that are the biggest ones, if you take those, put them together, those are more viewed than they come in number 4 only after Wikipedia, Microsoft, and Netflix worldwide.
Wow. Okay, that is.
There are on Pornhub itself, there are 28.5 billion visits per year on Pornhub, which is 81 million a day, 4 million an hour, and 56,000 views on Pornhub per minute. It's just a massive space where people are showing up. And most of these people who are showing up there are men, although 25 to 30% are women. And so it's just a really big part of sexual viewing, sexual thinking comes through porn. And in porn, men are seen to be having emotionless sex, sex that is performative. It's not connected, relational, lovemaking sex. So I
think and rooted in any type of longevity.
To be able to compartmentalize, like I'm just, sorry?
We're having a little bit of a bad connection. I was saying, and not rooted with the idea of longevity being part of the experience.
Yeah, right. Having it be more just a sexual act rather than a personal connection with another human being.
I think I would like to move towards conclusion on this extremely interesting talk. With trust, the idea of trust to me throughout my life has been very interesting because I think we set up trust as very unrealistic. I've always trusted that people are going to make mistakes because I make mistakes. So if I make mistakes, I'm assuming everybody else is going to make a few along the way. I used to produce live music for private events in Los Angeles and in Beverly Hills, Bel Air, Brentwood, the big high ticket net worth environments. They spend quite a lot of money on music. So I would go to all of these weddings, which I loved more than anything. Not only did I enjoy the ritual of it, but the food was unbelievable, as was the music. But I would stand at the ceremonies, and I would listen to the vows. And the vows are all about forever. I will love you forever. I will accept you forever. I will trust you forever. And I'm thinking, okay, you're young. That is absolutely not how life is going to play out unless you're so lucky. So I would always rewrite the vows in my head to say, I know we're going to screw up. I know we're going to make mistakes. Maybe we will even go outside of the relationship. But I really want to work to hold this one together. How about you? You know, something like that.
Nice. Really nice.
So trust, A, we have to trust that if we allow ourselves to be sexually expressive, it won't hurt our relationship. Would you speak to that?
Yes, I think that's such a beautiful way to conclude our conversation because I do think that when we allow ourselves to be sexually expressive and we allow our partner the same a beautiful gift to be sexually expressive, it may be messy at times. There may be things that happen that we feel offended by or upset by for some reason. But the truth is that when we do that, we're meeting another person in the place where they really live, in their true naked erotic expression, and we're not making them pretend to be something or someone that they aren't. And that way, our partner can feel completely accepted and will continue to be turned on together as we navigate the decades together in our relationship or marriage.
Any tips on how they can do this other than seeing you or working with a professional? How do you allow that to happen if you're initially scared?
The first piece, Judy, is to be honest with yourself about what you really want, what you personally really want. And after that, start to be brave enough to say those words out loud to your partner. There are so many of us who have hidden who we are. And maybe our partner thinks that we are completely asexual, for example. I had a client couple like that where he came to me and he said, my wife is asexual. And I talked with her and really she had her own sexual practice by herself. She had orgasm alone, but she was shy and she had not been able to tell him how to please her. So he never knew. He thought she just had no sex drive whatsoever. So it's really important to share with our partner what is true for us after we figure out what that is for ourselves.
I appreciate that, Jane. This has been great. This has really, really been great. So will you please come back in a few weeks after we all read your book and just talk about your approach, your specific approach to keeping sex alive in the relationship and choosing the right relationship to have this wonderful sexual experience.
Absolutely. I would be delighted.
So how should people get in touch with you between now and then?
They could find me on my website at howtofixmysexlife.com. That's the best way. In fact, I love people showing up over there right now because we're doing a virtual program for women starting, I don't know when our episode's going to air, but it's starting in the middle of October 2020.
Perfect. And this will air before then.
Great. So if you are a woman in a relationship or not in a relationship, it's the best and easiest way to work with me, a beautiful container of women who are going to be going through this conversation together. But there are other ways too, including like an overnight retreat where we can meet virtually and you and your partner can have all sorts of fun and sexy and confidential and fun experiences together. And so it's going to be fun. So howtofixmysexlife.com.
Excellent. And Jane's last name, which you will see when you see the show notes, her last name is spelled Gwyn, pronounced Gwyn, but it's spelled G-U-Y-N. Correct?
Right. Yes.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy that I met you. I love all of your ideas about this most important aspect of our lives. And thank you for your time being here, Jane.
It was a pleasure.
And thank all of you for listening to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host, amicable divorce expert. You can reach me through email, Judy, J-U-D-Y, at constructiveuncoupling.com, Judy at constructiveuncoupling.com, or through my website, divorceresourceinc.com, divorceresourceinc.com. Like this episode, share this episode, subscribe to the podcast. We all get to learn and grow together. Thank you so much. Talk to you all next week.